We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jeff Bossert, sitting in for Celeste Quinn, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Jason Croft. On September 26, 2008, Paul Newman died of lung cancer at the age of 83. Born in Shaker Heights, Ohio, raised in Shaker Heights, Ohio. He's the son of a sporting goods salesman. He was also a father of six, a grandfather, twice married, and appeared in 80 films as one of the most acclaimed actors of the past century. He was also very interested in political causes. He supported minorities, gay rights. He founded a camp for children with cancer and a line of food products, Newman's Own, that are still on grocery store shelves, and he had a huge career in auto racing. Today's guest is Sean Levy. He's a film critic for The Oregonian and has authored the books The Last Playboy, Ready, Set, Go, a Rat Pack Confidential, and The King of Comedy, a book about Jerry Lewis. His latest, published last year, is a biography called Paul Newman, A Life. Good afternoon, Sean.
Hi, thanks.
Thanks for joining us today. Tell us what drew you towards Newman's career and life and all the other things that he did outside of appearing in films and on stage.
Well, boy, you enumerated it really well. I think it's a remarkable life. If you're going to tell a story and take 170,000 words to do it, you want a big, meaty story, and Newman's is that. I also think it's an extraordinarily admirable story. I think that the story of Paul Newman's life and work and his values and the very man he was is worth telling. I think he's sort of a Mount Rushmore actor. So as a biographer, if you're going to leap into something and work on it for four-ish years, you want a story worthy of that effort. And I think as your introduction demonstrates, he's that guy.
And there were a lot of things that came out in this that we'll touch on throughout the hour that I didn't know about.
I did a lot of work.
I mean, I think I've seen reviews on Amazon and such that people weren't aware that he had an affair in the 60s, and just more of his maybe political causes he got behind and some other charitable work he did. Was there one or two things that were most surprising to you?
Well, it was more an accumulation. I think that if you look at the actor, the entrepreneur, the philanthropist, the race car driver, the race car team owner, humanitarian, the political man, I think four or five of those careers that he had would have qualified him for an obituary in the New York Times, and he did it all. So, you start thinking of the capacity of the man and the strength and the focus and the determination of the man, and that becomes what's most surprising. The individual facts are notable, but I think it's the accumulation that really takes your breath away.
We welcome your calls for Sean Levy. We're talking about his book, Paul Newman, A Life, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, or outlying area, 800-222-9455. Let's talk about his upbringing. Shaker Heights, Ohio, it seemed to be kind of a melting pot community. And what impact do you think growing up there had on his life?
Actually, Shaker Heights in the 20s, when Paul's family moved there, about 26 or so, when he was a toddler, was a planned suburban community. It was quite well-to-do. It wasn't restrictive like it was democratic in the great American 20th century melting pot sense, but it was well-to-do, so it wasn't sort of like a teeming immigrant section of Cleveland where his parents were raised. He was a child of comfort. His father ran the largest sporting goods store in between Chicago and New York. It survived the Depression. Think about that. They were selling radios and hockey sticks, and they survived the Depression. Probably 80% of sporting goods stores went out of business. The family took vacations. They had cars. They had subscriptions to the theater. You know, they were comfortable, even during the Depression. Not as comfortable as before, but comfortable. So I think there's a part of Paul Newman that sort of rebels against that. I think that, you know, you see roles like The Hustler and Cool Hand Luke, Butch Cassidy, Rick Pollitt and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Sometimes these people even have privilege and they don't like it. And I think there was something about him that was a little embarrassed by that, that he had to prove through hard work and toughness that he was not some, you know, sissy boy from the right side of the tracks.
Oh, and also took a large role, I mean, in terms of not only making films, but researching them a great deal, researching roles, and I don't know, I'm just thinking of something like Sometimes a Great Notion, where he's, you know, doing this logging work as if he were, you know, in this character, as if he were actually this person.
Yeah, yeah. He was about 48 when he made Sometimes a Great Notion, and he's running up trees in my neck of the woods in the Pacific Northwest. He also busted his ankle in a car crash during that shoot and was doing popping wheelies on motorcycles on the beach. He was kind of in a hell-raising mode. But, yeah, that he was a man's man in many ways. I mean, he was a race car driver, for goodness sake. That's a pretty specific maleness is attracted to that sport. And, you know, there's intelligence and there's craft and art to it, but there's also macho camaraderie and the community of race car drivers, you know, with their RVs and their barbecues. You know, Newman loved that stuff. He didn't want to be seen ever as privileged, not as a young man and not as a Hollywood superstar.
Well, what stands out for you in terms of his development as an actor? Maybe it was a time at Kenyon College, or where do you see the transition to, hey, I can do this, or hey, I found sort of this niche that, you know, maybe this could be a career instead of having to go back home and, you know, sell hockey sticks.
Right, right. Well, I think there's two things. I think that when he was introduced to the theater at Kenyon, and then he got into summer and winter stock, and then he was married, then his dad died, and he had to give up acting. But when his uncle sold the family business, Paul got a piece of that money, and he was able to attend Yale School of Drama. So he was taking it seriously, but I think, in his own words, he was pursuing an academic career so he could become a professor of theater arts. But he was too pretty, and he was cast. He was noticed by New York casting agents who came to New Haven to see the Yale students perform, and they brought him down to New York, and he got every job he could audition for. You know, it was the early 50s, so he had TV, Broadway and movies all in New York, plus advertising. So, you know, a guy with his looks, it was a no-brainer. People would put him in the show. And he got lucky with roles. He was in the original production of Picnic. I'm speaking about these financial things because I think he saw acting as a job, and if it wasn't a going concern, he would do something else because he had a family to support. But all that stuff that I just described led him up to attending the Actors Studio in its heyday, you know, when Lee Strasberg, Ilya Kazan, Luther Adler, Marlon Brando, Stella Adler, you know, the greats of the American method acting school were all involved with it. And that's where he learned to be an actor. You know, he really learned the emotional and technical responsibilities to do good acting. And he carried the ethos of the early Actors Studio with him his entire life as a performer, as a director, as a producer, as an aficionado. So I think he did those things on different tracks. There was definitely a business side to acting that he had to fulfill being his dad's son, but he learned the art and the craft at a relatively old age, you know, 30 for an actor, 28. So it was in that early 50s period, and he was very lucky. He was in the original production of Picnic. He was in the original production of The Desperate Hours. He was in a film that shot in New York City partly, Somebody Up There Likes Me. He had quality roles and good fortune.
You mentioned the Actors Studio. Do you think that is what I'm sure some of this is also just ingrained in him because of his upbringing and being a man's man. But he, as I mentioned before, he would go to these shoots in whatever city or community, not always prosperous places, but stay there for weeks and get into the role, and really just was a. You mentioned with the Actor Studio, he was also on the first episode of the Inside the Actor Studio with James Lipton and talked extensively. I watched some of that program recently about the art of acting and finding that character.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't it great on that show when he played the boogie woogie piano?
Oh yeah,
he could. That was a party trick he knew way back in college, high school even. Yeah. For him, studying a character, studying the script, living the role—that was doing your homework. He's very big on homework. You know, he's kind of a dogged fellow. He compared himself to a terrier. He, you know, I have a quote from him in the book: "I will get that bone," and that's how he went after his acting roles. And sometimes I think to the detriment of the role. I think, you know, as much as I esteem Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and The Hustler and Hud. And I think those are great performances. At the same time, I have a sense as a critic of seeing him turning switches, shifting, you know, sort of manually from moment to moment. And later in his career, particularly in the early 80s, soon after the drug overdose death of his oldest child, his only son, I think his acting changed. His whole life changed, really. But you see it in his acting because there's a certain fluidity and depth to the acting that even with his great talent and great craft he hadn't reached previously. And I don't know that method acting can teach you that, although by that stage in your career you should have the tools that you developed as a method actor as part of your arsenal and you bring them to bear. So it certainly helped him channel something new. But he was always a method actor. You know, people who were directed by him and people who worked with him, you know, said you could tell that he had that technique.
I think this might make a good your comments might make a good segue into something. I have some audio here from a few of his movies, and while our technical director is bringing that up, well, we're all set actually. Why don't we? I think this might make the jump from. Somewhat of that, you know, the late 50s, early 60s Paul Newman to the 80s one, and these both involve the same character. In the last few weeks, I tried to do my homework. I haven't watched nearly as much Newman as I wanted to, but these both involve Fast Eddie Felsen, the character from The Hustler and The Color of Money. We've got a couple of scenes here involving, again, that same character from both movies.
You shoot a good stick.
Thanks.
Gee, you shoot straight pool, mister?
Come on, then. You know how it is.
You're Minnesota Fats, aren't you?
You know, they say Minnesota Fats is the best in the country out where I come from.
Is that a fact?
Yes, sir. Boy, they say that old Fats just shoots the eyes right off them balls.
Where do you come from?
California, Oakland.
California. Is your name Felsen? Eddie Felsen?
That's right.
I hear you've been looking for me.
Pool excellence is not about excellent pool. It's about becoming something.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Like what?
A student. You gotta be a student of human moves. See, all the greats that I know of to a man. We're students of human moves.
Students of human moves.
Yeah, that's my area of excellence.
Again, those are two scenes from The Hustler and The Color of Money. The co-stars there, Jackie Gleason as Minnesota Fats, and Tom Cruise playing his student or the guy who tries to take
Vincent Lauria.
I couldn't remember the character's name.
He has a great shirt when he's working at the toy store that says,
"Oh yes,
Vincent."
Yes, and he tells him to keep that shirt on at least one point in the. I don't know if there's any particular reaction you have to those scenes in terms of the acting method. Of course, the latter film, The Color of Money, finally won Newman an Oscar after several failed attempts.
Well, you know, there's several interesting things. One is that, you know, you just hear the changes in the timbre of his voice and the pace of his delivery. You know, there's something clipped about the young Paul Newman and the young Eddie Felsen. And the older Paul Newman playing the older Eddie Felsen is much more, you know, whiskey-soaked and contemplative. But also, you know, you have this other dynamic always in the movies and in big Hollywood stories is that there's a nonfiction story. So you have the young Paul Newman who's becoming a leading man in 1961. And Jackie Gleason was no one's idea of a leading man, but he was one of the most popular entertainers in America at that time. And you see Newman sort of coming into the room and, you know, staking his claim to prominence. He dominated the 60s on box office lists always. And, you know, someone like Jackie Gleason sort of admitting him into the club. Then later you have the older Newman, the great marquee matinee idol, telling the up-and-coming matinee idol, Tom Cruise, some of the rules of the game. So it's a kind of charming transition biographically as well as artistically.
Or welcoming your calls for Sean Levy. We're talking about his book, Paul Newman, A Life, at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You mentioned a few minutes ago his performance on Broadway in Picnic. That's where he met his wife, Joanne Woodward. And I want to talk about that relationship. And it almost seems like a fairy tale today, the way their relationship developed, and considering as long as they were married until his death, and they had some bumps in the road, but compared to anything today, it's really, I think, developed as naturally as any other Hollywood relationship.
Yeah, it was a real marriage. You know, when they met, Paul was married with children. They met in 1952 or 53. Paul continued to grow after he met Joanne. So by the 1958, when he was with Joanne and living separately from his family, and Joanne became pregnant and they married in 1958, by that time, you know, it was clear that this was not just a lustful relationship. They had been through a lot of soul-searching and trauma together. Joanne was a daughter of a divorce, and that wasn't as common for a woman of her generation as it is today. And Newman married young, and I spoke earlier about his work ethic, you know, deriving from his father. He had a very strong moral sense, Paul Newman, and his the fact that he was falling in love with someone other than his wife was not easy for him. He suffered a lot through it. He drank a lot through it. He saw psychiatrists through it. So it was a relationship that began under some duress. But that said, it was a model Hollywood marriage, and a model marriage also of kind of frankness. You know, throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, until they simply seemed to have gotten bored with it, they would give interviews where they talked about, you know, how hard it was to be married with three kids and three kids from the husband's previous marriage and two careers, one of which was, you know, stratospheric. But she always had the trump card over him, Joanne did. She had the Oscar. She won an Oscar right after they were married for Three Faces of Eve, her third film. And he didn't win one, as you mentioned, till 1986.
We have a caller on line one in Urbana.
Hi. Just a local story. Many, many years ago, when Paul Newman was in a film with his wife called A New Kind of Love. Friday night in one of the downtown Champagne theaters, lots of students from the campus, and there's a scene in which he gives her a come-hither look, and you see his face on the screen. Half of that audience drew in a great deep breath, and then the other half, a few seconds later, laughed. And I mean, it was just audible. Every woman in that audience just went like that when those blue eyes and that face and that look came on the screen.
Yeah, I mean, he was a specimen, and he was a specimen his whole life.
That's right.
It embarrassed him. It truly embarrassed him. He said a wonderful quote late in life. He said, you know, I was always a character actor, but I looked like little Bo Peep.
Well,
he was too pretty.
And he was really incredible when he started worrying about other people and opening up the camp and speaking out about what he thought and things like that. That was also neat too. It made him a real person.
Yeah, well, I thank you for these comments, by the way. I think that the reaching out and thinking about other people and things other than his movie career is one of those changes I alluded to after the death of his son in 1978. Scott died of a drug overdose. He was a very troubled young man. He was 28 years old. And within 5 years, Newman's entire acting style had changed. He went from being an amateur racer to a professional racer. He started funding charities to do with drug addiction research, and he started the Newman's Own Food Company with the purpose of funding charities. And they've done that to the tune of $280 million-plus to this date. So I think that was a crucial thing, and it changed his life. And ironically, it was related to his being pretty, because if he hadn't been pretty, he wouldn't have been an actor, and if he hadn't been an actor, he wouldn't have been famous. If he hadn't been famous, he couldn't have made the food product sell, et cetera, et cetera. So the great thing that he did with his life, the charitable work and the courage of his convictions, kind of stemmed from the fact that he had those blue eyes that he regretted having.
Thanks for the call again. That was a nice story. What you were just saying kind of segues nicely into what I was thinking of. You mentioned a moment ago how Joanne Woodward had already won an Oscar, but she at one point said something along the lines of, "Paul is a great star. I'm a character actress," and because it seemed to be at some point they were kind of she was comparing the two of them in terms of their acting talent, Was she also trying to acknowledge those good looks you're talking about?
Well, I think she, you know, she was speaking first of all about the economic realities of the business. You know, when you say in Hollywood character actor, that's you know, so today you're talking about someone like Steve Buscemi. He's not going to open a $150 million budget film. You need a bigger star than that. Paul Newman was that guy. Joanne Woodward was never that gal. She knew that. But I think also, you remember, they were both committed method actors, and there's an inverse snobbery. You know, if a method actor is a character actor, that's the highest compliment. You know, whereas a movie star, you know, they come and go. But a character actor, I saw a movie last night, the new Roman Polanski film. It's got Eli Wallach in it, speaking of the Actors Studio, and he's in his 80s or 90s, and he sure is a character actor. So I think there's a little bit of reverse snobbery going on there, but it's also very true. And as I say, Newman became a character actor. You look at the roles he played after, pretty much after The Sting. He was trying, and The Sting, I'm not sure that isn't a character acting role. He was trying to play the non-glamorous parts, the challenging parts, the scallywags, the uptight, upright people. He was deliberately moving away from being a leading man.
Well, and I don't know if he regretted some of those choices, at least maybe not financially, but he had the parts in these couple of big budget disaster films, Towering Inferno, and what was the title?
The other one has three titles. It's
yes.
Commonly known as When Time Ran Out. It's dreadful. It was the last Irwin Allen disaster film, and it was made after Star Wars and Jaws and Close Encounters, so it looked like, you know, if somebody, you know, made a stop motion animation, you know, Ray Harryhausen style movie today. It just looked so wrong. It failed terribly, and that was the first film he made, sadly, after Scott's death, obviously because he'd been financially committed to it, and, you know, contractually committed and couldn't get out of it. And I think he was pretty embarrassed by that. And it's virtually the last bad choice, and maybe the only bad choice, truly. You know, Newman wasn't only in good movies. The 70-odd films he was in, there's some stinkers in there. But you can see that in the selection of collaborators and material and intent, there was some thought. You know, they may not have pulled it off, but you could see, for the most part, particularly after Butch Cassidy, when he was financially independent, there was always a purpose except for that film. That film, the only reason to be in it was money. I guess Towering Inferno, too.
I want to go back to briefly about the relationship with his wife. it's also really weird. They were in, what, 10 movies together? And mm-hmm. then there were five others in which he was a producer or director that she starred in. That's quite rare for, I guess, it's an indication of the longevity of their relationship.
Yeah, yeah. Stuart Stern, the a dear old family friend of theirs, the best man at their wedding, he says at one point in the book, Paul is always looking for a way to showcase Joanne so that the rest of the world can see what he sees in her. And I think that's an example of that. Every film he directed save one she appeared in, and that one was one that he took over mid-shoot because he fired the director. He talked about her craft his entire life in terms of awe. She, whatever was in that relationship that was real, she was responsible, I think, for more than half of it. Because if you were going to marry Paul Newman and keep his attention and his love and admiration for all that time, given all the competition that the world would have thrown before him, you really needed to be remarkable. He needed to be remarkable, but she had to endure who he was in addition to being a good partner, you know, in a typical marriage. So, in addition to being a fine actress, and boy, even in one of their last films appearances together, Mr. and Mrs. Bridge, he's good. He's really good, but he's so much more studied than her. She is India Bridge. There's just no question. And he's Walter Bridge, but there's something, I don't know, there seems to be something in reserve that she doesn't, she's not inhibited by.
We welcome your calls for Sean Levy. We're discussing his book, Paul Newman, A Life. Thought it was kind of fitting that their first on-screen kiss in the long, hot summer, it wasn't like they were in just some sort of corny romance film. He was this, you know, supposed barn burner who comes to this community, and it was, you know, he was sort of, I guess you'd say he was somewhat seducing her in the scene or whatever when he was in the role of this guy coming to town.
Ben Quick.
Yes, Ben Quick, and she's the daughter of Mr. Varner, the Orson Welles, the plantation owner, and he's trying to groom him into the role of marrying his daughter. I thought that was kind of interesting that they had this seductive on-screen kiss rather than something that was just sort of, you know, passive and
well, silly. Yeah, it's one of those moments like Bogey and Bacall in To Have and Have Not in The Big Sleep, where The what's happening off screen and what's happening on screen become sort of synonymous. The story of their marriage, you know, really begins earlier than that, Paul and Joanne's marriage. But you know, they were openly together on the set of The Long Hot Summer in Louisiana. The press agents for the films were very protective of them, as were the locals. Paul, you know, he had the habit of going down in advance so he could absorb the people and act like them better. Well, he made friends in Clinton, Louisiana, and when the press came snooping around to find the married star with his girlfriend, the locals made it clear that was not a healthy line of inquiry. Perhaps the reporter would like to go home, you know. So the things that the director, Martin Ritt, who became Newman's business partner and directed him multiple times, including HUD, captured that, you know, in a way that I think movie audiences responded to. And then, you know, soon after that, Newman was, the alcoholic, bisexual Brick Pollitt and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with, you know, pajamas and no top on for half the film. And, you know, you can see how he became a sex symbol. You know, the funny thing was he was a 35-year-old father of three or four at that time and paying alimony and supporting a widowed mother. And he was not, in his mind, a sex symbol.
Welcome your calls for Sean Levy, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You mentioned he's an alcoholic in Cat in the Hot Tin Roof, and a couple other characters that had affliction for drinking. And Newman himself would literally down cases of beer when he was, you know, in a in a day on a when he was on a shoot somewhere. I mean, he was a heavy drinker. I mean,
he was a heavy drinker,
and I guess that was something I didn't know about either. And how he continued to function and you know get on that set and you know do a great job every day is kind of beyond me.
He was a lifelong beer drinker. I mean, could just suck the stuff down. But he was also a lifelong fitness freak. I spoke to someone who was on a film set with him in the late 80s when Newman was about 63, 65, who said that they were filming in Mexico on an abandoned Air Force base, and Newman would ride a bike up and down the runways all day long because he told the guy he wanted to have those beers. And if he was going to drink those beers, he had to work them off. And he, you know, he caroused pretty hard in the late 60s and finally gave up the hard booze in about 72, not long after the shoot of Sometimes a Great Notion, which we spoke about earlier. And he became a wine connoisseur, you know. He became associated with food, insanely enough, late in life, after his 60s. And became, you know, he began to appreciate good wine, but he never boozed again like he did in his 40s. But he did drink a lot of beer. It's shocking. It's shocking to hear. Everyone you speak to says, yeah, I was at a black tie affair in New York, and Paul Newman came in with a six-pack of Coors Tall Boys, you know, and just sat and drank them while the rest of us had cocktails and wine. Or people would say, you know, at the racetrack, he would drink and drink and drink all day, not while he raced, never while he raced. He joked that it was the only thing he liked better than beer was racing a car, and that's so he never mixed the two. But, you know, in the racing community where you might spend 2-3 days at the track to race a two-hour race, you know, there's plenty of downtime. He had a deal with Budweiser as one of his sponsors. Part of the deal was they gave him 10 cases of Bud a week. You know, I don't know about your house. It would pile up around here. 10 cases a week? So, yeah. But you never have reports of him being too drunk to work. You never have reports of him, you know, crashing a car because he'd been drinking. He had this incredible metabolism. He was an alcoholic, and he found a way to live with it for decades.
We got a caller on their cell phone on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I joined the program late, but enjoying it a lot. And wondering, have you already spoken about Cool Hand Luke, the filming of it? And if not, could you tell us any stories in particular about the filming of that movie, which is my favorite?
Well, Cool Hand Luke was originally a Jack Lemmon vehicle. And Lemon's company wound up producing it. Newman was hired. The fellow Don Pierce, who wrote the novel and had kind of lived the life of Luke Jackson, was on the set of that film. He played one of the convicts, and he hated it. He hated Newman. He hated the film. He got into fist fights on the set all the time. A real a macho production, you know. Dennis Hopper, Wayne Rogers, Dean Stanton. Harry Dean Stanton. They, you know, about 6 or 8, you know, sort of tough guy actors. George Kennedy, of course, and they filmed it in Central California, although it was supposedly based in the South. They shipped in Spanish moss. And Newman researched the role in West Virginia. That's where he, in his mind, always had the film set. You know, there's all sorts of little career ironies, too. The actress who plays his mother in that film, Jo Van Fleet, Newman screen-tested in 1953 or 54 for the role opposite James Dean in East of Eden, which went to an actor whose name, I want to say Adam Clymer, I'm probably misremembering. And that fella appears in Cool Hand Luke as one of the prisoners. And Newman would have played that role in East of Eden, and Jo Van Fleet would have been his mother in that film. So, you know, odd little things go on in Hollywood like that. And Newman loved the film. I think it's a great film. I mean, speaking as a film critic, if you can get a Blu-ray or an HD version of that film, watch it tonight, because it's so much prettier than you remember. Conrad Hall, the great, great Conrad Hall, whose last film was a Newman film, The Road to Perdition. He shot that. It's the music. if you've ever seen Eyewitness News in any city you ever live, that dun 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 dun, that's Lalo Schifrin's score for Cool Hand Luke. Terrific film.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for the hour, for the call, and we're down to like the last 10 minutes or so. You credit the fact that Newman worked with so many great directors in shaping him. I mean, we mentioned Martin Ritt, Otto Preminger, George Roy Hill, Martin Scorsese directed him in his one Oscar-winning role.
He worked with the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
Hudsucker Proxy. He worked with Michael Curtiz, who made Casablanca, on a dreadful film, but nevertheless. Sam Mendes directed him in The Road to Perdition. He worked with John Lasseter on Cars, one of the great animation directors of our time. You know, so he when he became Paul Newman after about 1960, he could choose who he wanted to work with. He had some favorite collaborators. George Roy Hill, he only made three films with, but they're really great. Butch Cassidy, The Sting, and my favorite, Slapshot. When he got to that stage in his career, as I say, as a method actor, you know, it's all about process and working it out, workshopping it. Newman liked to say that the ideal film would be rehearsed, and then shot with no film in the camera, and never shown. You know, that was his mentality. I think there was a part of him that always wished he could have been in the theater, but how could you say no to the money and the opportunities that a film career offers. he worked with Alfred Hitchcock. He had great respect for directors, and particularly after he directed himself. And he was a director of note. Rachel, he won the New York Film Critics Prize as Best Director, and he was nominated for an Oscar. The film was nominated for Best Picture. He wasn't nominated for Best Director. There's always one of those, although this year they nominated 10 pictures, so all the directors are in. He directed a very nice adaptation of The Glass Menagerie with Joanne Woodward and Karen Allen and John Malkovich. He directed for television a very nice version of The Shadow Box, the film about the Pulitzer Prize-winning play about the hospice patients in California. Joanne was in that as well, and Christopher Plummer. So, you know, he had respect for the craft of directing, and I think it made him choose, you know, the ideal collaborators. In virtually every film he made after about 1960, the director is someone worthy of his talent.
Someone we didn't mention was Sidney Lumet, and I've got a clip here from The Verdict. Because this is the film, really, that everybody thought at that time he was going to finally win the Oscar for. Mm-hmm. And why don't we go ahead and listen to that? It's a pretty brief clip.
I'm an attorney on trial before the bar representing my client. My client. You open your mouth, you're losing my case for me.
Now listen to me, Phil.
No, you listen to me. All I want on this trial was a fair shake. Okay? Push me into court 5 days early. I lose my star witness, and I can't get a continuance, and I don't care. I'm going up there, I'm going to try it, I'm going to let the jury decide. You know, they told me about you. Said you're a hard ass, you're a defendant's judge. Well, I don't care. I said to hell with it, to hell with it.
That was Milo O'Shea as the judge in that scene from The Verdict. And he still, you know, after all this praise and I guess a lot of promotion, I believe he was on the front page of, was it Time or one of the major magazines when the film came out, still didn't win the Oscar.
Well, he lost the Oscar that year to Ben Kingsley for Gandhi, and, you know, the Oscar is the Oscar. I mean, for goodness sake, you know, there's only one homecoming king each year, and there might be two deserving candidates, whatever. He was nominated 10 times in competitive categories. He won once. Tatum O'Neal was nominated once and won once. What could those statistics possibly mean next to each other, you know? It's clearly his Sistine ceiling as an actor. It's the most heartfelt, grueling, lived-in, natural, emotive, generous performances, naked, that you'll see anyone do. It's really one of the great performances using the method acting techniques of the Actors Studio on film. And I don't think Newman saw Oscars as a, you know, he loved to talk about auto racing because in auto racing there was an objective criterion of judgment. My bumper is here, your bumper is there, I win. And he understood his misfortune as an actor. Why didn't he win for HUD? 1963, lost to Sidney Poitier in Lilies of the Field. Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, The Hustler. Those were great roles, and those were early in his career, and, you know, often Oscar will shine on somebody at that moment. So he lost a lot of times when he should have won. I don't think it haunted him much. And the irony of him winning for The Color of Money was that the previous year he had agreed to receive a Lifetime Award, and then the next year he won. And that had happened, ironically, previously with Henry Fonda. He got a Lifetime Award, and then he won for On Golden Pond the following year. It was a strange thing that went on in a strange world of Oscars. But it is, you know, Oscar is a big deal, and it's always the lead of your obit if it's, you know, the Oscar-winning writer or something. So, you know, there is some validity to it. I don't think, though, Newman ever had to think too much or too long about, you know, where he stood in the community in Hollywood. He was a highly regarded figure from 1960 to until his death almost 50 years later.
You mentioned the auto racing career, and then one of the quotes, I don't recall where this was, but he has said, after a string of wins, you know, meaning on the racetrack, he said, you know, perhaps now they'll stop taking me for a stupid actor. He really wanted to be taken seriously in this other career.
Yeah. As he worked at being an actor, he worked at being a race car driver. He didn't pick it up really until he was almost 50. He raced on an amateur circuit, which has regional races, and about six times he qualified from his region for the national championships, and he won five national championships. He won two races as a professional driver in his late 50s, running against guys who raced every weekend. He finished second in the 24 Hours of Le Mans at age 54, and at age 70, he won on a team at the 24 Hours of Daytona. He took the checkered flag in an all-night race at age 70, and raced back on that amateur circuit until his 80s. It was a real career for him. He owned a team in the very highest level of racing, the IRL League, and they won seven national championships when he was a team owner, and he was an involved owner. In the race world, he's thought of as extremely talented and good-natured fellow. I mean, there's never any disrespect for him. When he first came up, there was suspicion, oh, if Hollywood pretty boy, he's just, you know, blowing his money, he'll be gone. And he earned his stripes and then some. He's revered in the racing world.
And something else we didn't really get a chance to touch on yet was his involvement in all these causes, not just helping children with cancer with setting up a camp, but also a lot of political campaigning on many's behalf. And he spent some time with the UN on a General Assembly special session on disarmament. He also had a bit of a debate going with Charlton Heston regarding the Reagan administration's arms policies.
Yeah, he was a committed progressive, although he was a libertarian, and he supported John Anderson, for instance, in 1980 when Jimmy Carter was running for re-election against Ronald Reagan. You mentioned the camp. Actually, there's upwards of 15 camps, and they're all around the world at this point. The hole-in-the-wall camps. And since they started about 15 years ago, they have given free summer vacations and medical care to more than 200,000 children with grave diseases. It's just, and that was something that came out, you know, 10, 15 years into the other charitable career that he'd begun with the food products. It's a separate business. But he was a committed lefty. He stuffed envelopes for Adlai Stevenson. He was a delegate to the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago alongside his fellow Connecticuter, Arthur Miller. He campaigned for Ned Lamont against Joe Lieberman in 2006. I mean, he's constantly a public citizen. He marched in. He visited the Deep South during a civil rights auto workers strike, and spoke to the people on the factory floor. He was at the March on Washington in 1963. He was he was very serious about his political beliefs, and he believed strongly that he should be allowed to have them, even though the job he chose to do in his life was actor. You know, people criticize actors for having public opinions, but if he'd been a sporting good retailer, no one would have said anything. That was his thought. So he felt entitled to speak his mind.
Am I correct? Newman's Own is, and it's still on the shelves. Is that's being run by his daughter now?
Newman's Own. Well, the other founding partner, A. E. Hotchner, is still alive, and
okay.
He has a memoir of his friendship with Paul coming out this spring or soon. And Nell Newman, who started the organics division of Newman's Own, is a key in it. I'm not 100% sure, you know, as of this date, who is running that company and who will be running that company. Nell is pretty vital and active.
What I love is that with Newman's Own up and going, you mentioned in the book that he started to understand the romance of business, and it took him this long in life to have somewhat of his father in him.
Yep. He ran away from the family business, and then he wound up being a multimillionaire businessman. And he loved that. There's a great quote. He says, I marvel at the circularity of life. That's wisdom for you. You know, he was almost like a guru at the end. Some of the things he said about driving, about Joanne, about acting, the full experience of his life was in his words and deeds, and toward the end, just remarkable. If you see his 2003 performance in Our Town as the stage manager, a role that he'd played in Summer's Stock in 1949, it's just one of the great performances by an American actor. He's Your first question was, how do you choose someone like this? And I'm thinking, how was I so lucky that there hadn't been a really robust biography of this guy in, you know, 20-odd years, that there was a hole on the bookshelf that I could fill? That's my question.
Well, we got to wrap things up. We could have easily gone on for 2 hours, I think, of all the stuff that he's been, films he appeared in and all the other things he did on the side. So, Sean, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
And Sean Levy's book is... Paul Newman, A Life. It's published by Harmony Books.